Good morning, this is Michael Collins with UW Extension Cooperative Extension. I'm a family living specialist, and today we're going to talk about online strategies for financial learning. This is part of the financial education series that we have called Lunchtime Learning. All the materials that I'll talk about for today's call are on the website fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series. There you'll find links to many of the tools and techniques I'm going to talk about today, as well as an issue brief in a green box that says using new learning strategies for online financial learning. And that will bring up a PDF document, which I will go through today. Unlike calls in the past, we also have a number of the links that are listed in the PDF on the website itself. So you'll see below the brief a grouping, a different kind of grouping of the links that I'll be talking about today. So as we talk about online technologies, much of what I'll be talking about actually will be online. So it's fine if you're listening in today to be clicking on links and following along or checking out information as you surf along. Just a reminder for folks that this series does take place every month, and the goal is to introduce financial educators in Wisconsin or otherwise to some new cutting-edge ideas or content or techniques in community-based financial education. And today we'll spend about the next half hour or so talking about this topic of online strategies for learning. My goal with today's call is really to help educators think about maybe one thing that they could do in the next 4 to 6 weeks that would be new to them. So maybe you're already doing Twitter. Maybe you're already using Facebook. So maybe you might think about using an infographic or creating a video. Or maybe you're already doing video and you might think about doing some kind of online game as part of your learning. So I challenge everybody to, as they hear today, the kinds of topics I'm talking about, what they might do to change their approach to these kinds of techniques. I should note, too, that the issue of how to use technology in education isn't just confined to folks who are in the financial education area. It's true for all education. So we could be talking about family education or nutrition or, you know, any number of other areas where these techniques would apply equally as well. So don't think any of this is really unique to the financial context. Let me start by just saying I think one of the things we often hear from educators around the state and around the country is, well, technology is great, but we live in a place where there isn't high-speed internet. We don't have fiber optics. We don't have these cable operators. You know, people really just either can't afford or don't have access to high-speed internet. And so, you know, that conversation is changing in some ways because now more and more places do have the basic infrastructure. But the big change has been the advent of the cell phone, the smartphone. You know, the numbers we've seen recently about the share of people at all income levels who have internet-enabled phones has gone up remarkably. It's, you know, close to 60% of the general population and as much as 30% of lower-income population. A lot of people who don't have computers or other, you know, traditional forms of technology do have tablets or smartphones and have internet access from that. The other thing we've seen is just more and more internet access at work, at school, at libraries. And so when we do surveys of people about online access, the share who say, I have no online access at all is very, very low. Even among older populations, the penetration has gone way up. And so there still are pockets of places and people who aren't technology enabled, but it's becoming less and less of a barrier than it used to be in the past. And I think in some ways that has changed the dialogue about what's possible. The other thing we've seen is just more and more financial content is online only. So finding a print version of documents is becoming harder and harder. And there's almost an assumption now among providers of curricula, of calculators, of different kinds of tools, techniques, that the way to deliver is online. However, much of the rollout of financial education online hasn't been well informed by what works. So we don't really have any evidence about, whether a, click-through process where people get questions about what they just read every 2 minutes is better than a video-based online education process versus some combination of blended learning where you have a video and then you meet in person, and then you read some things online, and sort of they're back and forth. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about today are sort of discrete tools and techniques. And my sense right now of where this field is it's more of an art than a science. It's what works for you and for your learners, what you're comfortable with, and what's effective for them. And so that's going to be different from community to community and from learner to learner. And, you know, it's part of what makes this field fun is trying to figure out the new ways that we can approach topics and keep it more interesting for us as educators, but also hopefully broadens our effectiveness. It enables us to reach new audiences, maybe younger audiences who would never come to a face-to-face workshop, people who can't come physically to a workshop or from the times don't work given their other schedules and their lives. So I think there's great possibilities going forward, but I also would say this is a sort of shared experiment that we're all going through together to try to figure out what makes sense. And maybe a year and a half, or 2 years from now, we can have another call like this where we actually hear back from folks about, okay, this worked and this didn't for this population in this context. And, you know, I would fully expect us to have different answers about what works going forward. All right, so let me talk a little about what I mean when I'm saying using technology. And I'm thinking very broadly about what I mean by technology. This might mean smartphones. It might mean simple text messages on dumb phones, you know, phones that aren't internet-enabled. Using videos either in class or as a follow-up to a class or maybe in lieu of a class. Online games, so you can imagine where much of the learning takes place in the online game, and then your role as an educator is to debrief, especially with kids. Or online games that are used as a follow-on or as a conversation starter in a traditional setting. You know, we can also think about a lot of these tools as not necessarily part of your educational process, but part of your marketing process that helps attract learners to come to your traditional program. So maybe this is more about getting people into the programs that you already do. Or maybe we can think about this as a way to leverage the impact of what you do. So it's not about getting people in the door or doing something online instead of doing something in the classroom. It's about a follow-up to see if people actually follow through to change their behavior, to follow their goals, or to enroll in the program, or whatever it is that you did your teaching about. So we can think about these technology tools as having lots of different strategic roles for you as an educator. Maybe it's to bring people in the door. Maybe it's to increase your scope, or to increase the scale, or widen your audiences. Maybe it's just to do what you're doing now, but to have greater impact, because you do some follow-ups, some reminders, or some other ways to enhance the learning that you did in your traditional setting. So it's hard to think of a situation where somebody truly wouldn't use any of these. You know, there's probably some aspects of these tools and techniques that could apply to just about everybody. And so I think the challenge is thinking about what makes the most sense given your learners and your situation. So what I'm going to try to do with today's call is go through a number of the strategies and the technology tools that you might think about. From social media, from the idea of using either recorded video or recorded audio, using existing videos that are available through other sources, even using existing courses. More and more courses are being moved online, and how you might think about piggybacking on those. Using visual tools, using video, for more face-to-face direct video, games, and different tools like that. So I see this as just kind of a survey of tools that are out there, but hopefully one or more of them are some that you haven't worked with and you maybe could think about trying to work with. So I'm going to start with this broad category of social media. It seems like there's a new social media tool or technique or company being launched all the time. But I'm going to focus mainly on Facebook, Twitter. Those are kind of the two big ones that we see educators using quite a bit. Another one's called Instagram, which is basically a picture, a site where you can post pictures. Sounds like somebody might have an open mic. You might want to mute because we're getting some feedback. Thanks. So Instagram is really just for pictures, but it's kind of like Twitter. Instead of 160 characters, it's a picture that you can post. And there's another site called LinkedIn, which is more of a professional networking site, but I'll talk about all of these together. The value of these systems is that a lot of learners already know about them. They might already have a Facebook page or have a Twitter account or follow somebody on Twitter. And so this provides an avenue for you to market your program as well as to follow up with your learners. So for example, if you had a Twitter account, you know, maybe a Twitter account specific to your educational activities, you could encourage your learners to sign up and follow you on Twitter. So they would follow you, and as you heard about financial education opportunities in the community or maybe an article in the paper that you want to promote, you could tweet that out to your followers. And your followers would be basically people who've been through your courses before. So that's just a simple way to follow up with people. You could also remind them about, say, tax time opportunities, or one of the things we like to do with the Check Your Credit campaign is use Twitter to remind people to check their credit. And we even have a hashtag for that particular campaign. And Facebook can play a similar role. Instead of having followers like you would have on Twitter, you have friends, and so, you know, they can friend your financial education program if you had a Facebook account for your education program, or for your county extension or some other organization or partnership or coalition that you might have in your community. In some cases, you can actually have the things that you tweet on Twitter posted directly to Facebook, so you can almost do two for one. The items that you put out on Twitter automatically feed into the Facebook website. Twitter and Facebook are essentially free, although, you know, they're not really free because there are ads that are based on what's going on both those websites. But in terms of you and your learner, really nobody's paying a direct price for that. It's the advertisers who are trying to get you to view whatever it is they're putting out there. The other nice thing about both Facebook and Twitter is they are really engineered to work well on phones and tablets and small screens, not just on computers. You don't have to have super fast bandwidth to make either of those applications work. And then there's one nice thing about those tools is you can easily share links with your followers or your friends in either case. So for example, I included a link here to an article in the New York Times that talked about different apps people can install on their phones to track their finances. And so that's an example of the kind of tool, if you saw something like that, you could share it and just say, hey, here's a tool I found, seems kind of useful, you might want to check it out. In terms of, you know, Instagram or LinkedIn, I think those are pretty similar in structure and probably not quite used as much. So those can be other tools that people could use in the social media area. In general, I think these are pretty low cost. They're not hard to learn. You may already be active in them. It's just a matter of creating another account. If somebody have an open line, we're still getting some feedback. If you mute if you can. Thanks. The downsides are that sometimes learners can feel like it's just too much information. And so, you know, if I follow 150 different people, I may not follow everything that you put out there. The other thing is that, you know, there are a lot of folks out there providing information like this, and so, in some ways I think it's important for trusted people like you to be out there, because you can cut through the din. And when there's so much, non-objective information out there or self-promoting information out there, to have something out there where you're trusted, I think can be an important, role for us to play. I've included a bunch of links in this area, everywhere from calculators to resources that are available. The Center for Financial Security does have a Twitter feed, so you can see that feed at UW-Madison-CFS. And one thing you can do if you're an educator and you have a Twitter account is just retweet the things that somebody else puts out. So a lot of what UW-Madison-CFS puts out is a retweet of what somebody else put out, somebody that we trusted. But it helps extend the reach of those tools. There is a Journal of Extension article from 2010 I linked to here that talks about social media tools. And then there's another piece from Journal of Extension in 2011 that talks about, again, more ways that social media can be used. So these are our topics that are covered in Journal of Extension and are being used by extension educators nationally as well. So I'm going to move on then from social media to webinars and podcasts. So you've probably watched webinars, and maybe you've listened to podcasts. Even if you don't have an iPod, you still might listen to them on whatever your listening device is or listen to them online. These are, if you've never made either a video or an audio recording, they're actually pretty easy to use, particularly with tablets or with you know, some of the built-in features in laptops and computers today. You know, oftentimes webinars are live. So it might be a live broadcast of a streaming broadcast of a presentation that you're doing or of an event that you're doing. Other times we just record and then post. So it's not live and it gives you some time to do some editing. The difference between the video recordings and the webinars is really that you get more chances to add bells and whistles. So whether it's graphics or you know, different kinds of tools like that. Podcasts are audio only. Those are almost always recorded, so it's rare that we'd see a live podcast. But it's, you know, it's still a tool that's out there and you know, oftentimes can be really quick and easy to do. You know, I would say that the value of a webinar is really that you can get information out around an event and you can record it. So it's almost like a twofer, you know, as opposed to when you produce something, a video, and then post it, you really, you know, it's just whatever the ongoing viewers of it are. A lot more people will tend to watch it live than they will something that's posted later, although over time you'll obviously accumulate more and more people that watch it. You know, the advantage of the editing is not insignificant. I mean, being able to edit out the dead spaces or the mistakes or, you know, add a little bit of music or, you know, do some graphics are pretty valuable. It makes things much more watchable. The one thing I think we've learned in general for how we think about producing videos is that they need to be short. People's time and attention span for a video, unless it's really engaging or like a really, you know, well-rehearsed lecture, is pretty short. So, you know, a lot of the research we're seeing right now and just generally in terms of how people view online videos is 5 minutes is the outest, you know, the longest that people will typically stay with a session. And, you know, shorter is better. 3 minutes are more likely to be viewed in the first place than 5 minutes. And people are more likely to stick longer if it's a shorter video. So, you know, oftentimes if you're delivering a topic, you might end up having to break it up into part one, part two, part three, part four. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does mean a little bit more planning about when you break and how you break it up. You can even record everything in one, say, half an hour session and then break it up as well. So that's another option as well. Podcasts are, you know, a little different in that people will download podcasts and maybe listen to them on their iPad or in their car or those kinds of things. So you could go longer on those. It's really easy to produce a podcast. It's just a recording. Your computer probably already gives you the ability to do that. We have heard that little things, like a little bit of, you know, 10 seconds of introductory music and a voiceover is a good thing, as well as at the end. It sort of visually, or I'm sorry, it audio cues you sort of pay attention and to prepare for the session. The harder thing with podcasts is you can't really provide links. You're just using words. And so with video, you can actually show pictures and include links, those kinds of things. So both, you know, both techniques, I think, are probably more accessible than you think. You probably already have the software and the hardware to make these happen. My experience has been that both for podcast and video, having a better microphone than is built in your computer or your tablet is a good idea. But microphones are relatively cheap. You can get a good one for $25-$30 and a really good one for $50. So, you know, it's probably worth a little bit of investment on a microphone. But video-wise, most cameras built in or the auxiliary cameras, the webcams that you can buy are pretty good. So it doesn't take a big investment there. Software-wise, there's a little bit of a learning curve on using some of these software, but it's, you know, the basic features are pretty accessible. So, you know, even things like adding music and graphics are just a few clicks away. I included some links here both to some examples of a podcast and then to some step-by-step how to do a video from another journal of extension article. And then also there's a link to the Center for Financial Security webinars, which are examples of live webinars that we do and then post. And again, most people watch them live, but some people do go back and watch them later. So related to this idea of video is YouTube. So you probably know YouTube. It's a the largest video sharing website. You can create your own channel, or you can use the Cooperative Extension channel that already exists, and you can upload materials. You know, this can range from very short, say, you know, a 30-second clip promoting a future event, to, you know, a longer, you know, up to an hour sometimes clip of a lecture or of a presentation. You know, oftentimes these might be used in a live education setting, so you might actually show a video to break up your content a little bit, particularly if it's something that is engaging and, you know, might present something that's hard to do in the classroom without a video. So, you know, an example of actually doing something, you know, going through a credit report or filling out some kind of a form or understanding some process where you can visually show it better than you could describe it, you know, sort of upfront in classroom. You know, YouTube is probably the main tool that we see for sharing videos, in part because they do have an educational account and educational platform, and you can actually set up a channel yourself, or your educational initiative can, that's labeled as an educational platform. And you have the choice on these postings to make these accounts either private, meaning just the people you share the videos with, or public, meaning that anybody can see it. And so you do actually have more control than you might realize. What you watch on YouTube is obviously the public stuff, but you can sort of narrow that channel a little bit in terms of how you do your settings. You know, one thing that say about the videos that are posted on YouTube is that quality matters. People don't watch the really poor quality videos. So, you know, having a good microphone and a little bit better, you know, a little bit better editing and music and those kinds of things might help. There is a link here to the YouTube education site, listed in the both the brief and the website, so you can learn more about how YouTube supports videos in the education area. Another tool to know about is Khan Academy, and so if you've been particularly, I think, during the Packers games, there have been these ads that have been run with Bank of America supporting Khan Academy. So Khan Academy is actually a startup of a guy who started doing videos for his cousin or niece or something like that in math, and sort of just realized he was good at doing online tutorials, and then created a nonprofit organization to promote these free videos. Are used widely in school. I use them with my undergraduates even. But they did a deal with Bank of America where Bank of America underwrote a series of financial literacy class called Better Money Habits. They're pretty good. I would say their average is 4 to 7 minutes long. Basically a whiteboard where they describe different aspects of personal finance. Some are better than others. I mean, you'll have a different taste for which parts you like. Obviously they are topics that are near and dear to, you know, a large bank. So, you know, they're interested in things like home buying. And, you know, they have some vested interest in that, but I don't think any of the content itself is in any way biased towards one particular financial institution, in any way that we should be, you know, skittish enough about using it. One thing that's nice about this site is that you as an educator can, set up a system so that students can go through the courses and you can sort of monitor their process. So they have this, like, coach aspect where you have people sign up. As they complete a video, it reports back to you, and you can sort of assign tasks and keep track of sort of how they're moving through the educational process. So it really is a interactive tool for you as an educator to work with students who are not in the classroom. So it provides you a direct way to do education that mimics some of maybe what you would do in a classroom, but completely online. And so I think it provides a really nice platform. Assuming these are the topics for the learners that you're interested in working with and are appropriate, and I would say that the Khan Academy site does require a better bandwidth, so it's certainly not something that would work very well in an old dial-up type internet connection, but does require better internet connection. It works okay on smartphones. It works pretty well on tablets. But it does have these nice features where people can log in and you can track information going forward. You know, it isn't that well populated yet. I think they may continue to add more pieces to it, but you can check it out at the Better Money Habits website or the Khan Academy website to learn more about it. The next thing you may have heard of is this terribly named concept called a MOOC, a Massive Online Open Course. These have been covered broadly in the media. They have been described as everything from the end to higher education to what's going to keep higher education going forward. But they are, just like they sound, massive courses. So you find a really big name professor who's teaching something. You lecture capture the course and you stream it. You have assignments that are online. And just, you know, over the course of a 12-week course, you know, following a sort of typical course pattern, students tune in, they watch the video, they do their assignments, they, you know, they work with other students in the online course, and if they complete all of it at the end, they, you know, sort of get acknowledged for completing the course. They are not necessarily getting credit, so that's an important thing to realize, is that a lot of the people who take and complete these courses are not enrolled, and so they're really just doing it for their own personal learning. It's not a for-credit course. But most of them have the option to pay some money, obviously, to the financial institution that's the sponsor, and to get some credit. That's the sort of the cutting-edge part of this, is how does it interact with the traditional undergraduate credit. But you can see lots of examples of these online. Wisconsin actually offers some now. The videos tend to be pretty short. The lectures are not, you know, an hour and 15 minutes like you might typically see in higher ed, but shorter than that. And there's always a forum so students can interact with each other or interact with the professor or the teacher. And then there's online quizzes and exams. I've taken one of these. I did not complete it. I'm not alone. About 90% of the people who start these courses don't finish them. You know, one thing I would highly recommend you do is just enroll in one. There's financial literacy or financial education courses at a couple of universities right now. There's one on pension finance that's out right now. So there's a few of these out there, and they're not terribly hard to find. You do have to sign up, but don't worry. Once you sign up, there's really no way for them to, you know, you'll get the assignments, but there's no way for them to find out if you actually are following through or not. So you don't have to feel like you're committed, and which is why a lot of people do drop out. But I do think that they are worth exploring, and in some cases you might find content that helps you become a better educator. Or there might be a course that is, you know, exactly in an area where you have a group of learners, and you might actually encourage them to enroll, maybe enroll with you or enroll with each other, and then sort of help coordinate their movement through it. So they actually do complete the course, and they do work on the assignments together. They do work on the project together. So you can almost think of this as a localized facilitation of this, longer education program that people might be engaged in. It's definitely very new. UW is just beginning to experiment with this. There is a website called class.central where you can see what's being offered or will be available. And then at UW, it's called edinnovation.wisc.edu, where they have some information about the MOOCs that are available to UW-Madison. There's also a nice, there's a link to a discussion paper from the Ed Innovation people at Madison, so you can learn more about MOOCs. I definitely think it's something to watch, and at the very least a way for us to build our own skills, if not a way to work with our learners and communities as well. The next tool is a pretty simple one called an infographic. These are great. I increasingly see these in newspapers or magazines. And in classrooms where, you know, instead of having a bunch of PowerPoint slides, you hand out an infographic or you just put up an infographic on the screen, and it can do so much. An infographic is a visual information of a bunch of data. And it might be quantitative data, it might be more qualitative data, but it shows processes, it shows movements, it shows relative scale, you know, big and small. It provides information in a really easy to understand format. Oftentimes it's used to explain research findings or program findings. You see them a lot in newspapers when they're describing sort of a complicated event. Like there's been a lot of infographics lately on the healthcare reform, and the take up of individual accounts or of individual, insurance plans. I think infographics are a lot easier to use than they might look. There's a couple of websites there, mostly ad-based. Some of them offer sort of a free basic subscription, and then for a small monthly fee, you can get a more robust subscription. I will say one way to think about getting infographics done is if you ever have an intern, particularly a high school or college age intern who's really good with technology, they can make an infographic in a couple of hours that just looks amazing, or maybe even faster than that. You know, I don't think you can do these for everything, but they are, you know, pretty simple to create using these online tools. You can create a PDF of them, you can post them online, you can tweet them, you can print them, you can put them on your website, you can put them on your Facebook page. So it is a way to I think, get across relatively dense material in a fast way. Another tool I want to talk about is basically a person-to-person video call. So I know these are less about education and more about counseling, but I know, you know, oftentimes counseling and education blend with each other. You have a client who attends a course and then they need some follow-up for counseling or coaching. And, you know, you might do this on the phone. You might ask yourself, like, why do I need to see them? It's fine. We can just do this on the phone. And, you know, obviously that's completely contextually based. So if that's where you and the client are, that makes total sense. But there are times when it is important to see somebody, just to be able to understand the body language, to see the facial expressions, or sometimes more importantly, to go over documents. So with tools like Skype and FaceTime and Google Hangout, you can actually share desktops. So you can show a document on your desktop and they can show a document on their desktop. So if you were talking about getting to a form or understanding information, documents, those kinds of things, you can actually do that in real time while you have a video call going. So the video part might end, but then you move, you know, you shift so that you actually see the document that's on your desktop instead. It's a nice tool. I think it also is nice because you can know what people are really paying attention and, they can work pretty well if there's really focused attention of your counsel to your client as you're going forward. The difficulties here are that this does really require a good bandwidth. It's difficult to do this on just a cell phone. It will work, but it's not unusual to see the screen freeze or for the sound to get choppy. Those kinds of problems can crop up. You really do need to have pretty good service on both ends, and a lot of clients may not have the ability to do that, so it's an issue. And it's also not really appropriate to do in a library or a work setting, so you really are limited in the sort of the scope of how clients can use these. There's links here about Google, Skype, and Apple, and how these can be used in an education setting. I think these are probably less likely to be used by folks who are doing community-based education. But when push comes to shove and you really have somebody in a situation where you can't physically meet and you need to be able to see each other and share documents, it might be a solution to have in your toolbox. Last thing I'm talking about is online games. And usually when we think about online games, and I think a couple of years ago we did one of these calls about online games aimed at kids, so financial education games online. But there are online games that aren't just aimed at kids, and there are online games that are aimed at kids that are actually good for adults. And so I want to just broaden the way we think about games and to include this broader set. I do think that games can be a tool that get people into a class. They can get people engaged at a class, and they can be used as a follow-up tool after class. So there's lots of ways we can use these to introduce topics. And sometimes a game is a more fun and less intimidating way to talk about things that people don't want to talk about. Or a way for kids to talk about issues with their parents that parents don't want to talk about. So it can be a way to start that conversation at a family level that may be one of your goals in education as well. Many of these games are pretty simple. They don't require super fast bandwidth. They do work on tablets. Even if you had a few tablets in an education space or at the start of a workshop, that might be one way to think about getting engaged in this kind of learning. There are a number of links that I've included here, including one from the Federal Reserve where they list some games that they work on. There's the mymoney.gov website, which is from the Department of Treasury and other federal agencies. So these are tools for teachers and educators that they've identified. There is a website from Disney, which is obviously a for-profit company, but not a financial company as far as I know. And they offer some nice games on their website, the Disney Go website. And then there's the Money As You Grow, which I think we've talked about before. but as a set of financial lessons and activities that are put online. So again, my goal today was just to go over a number of different tools that are available out there. I know a lot of educators say, this is for somebody younger than me, or I'm not comfortable with this, or my learners aren't comfortable with this. And now I just challenge you, there's a lot of different ways to think about these. And there might be one tool or two tools here that actually you might be able to use and think about or just play with. It might be fun for you, and it might help both impact your learners more or to broaden the scope of people that you work with. Most of these tools are relatively inexpensive at this point. Like I said, other than maybe a microphone, I don't think you need to invest in expensive cameras or software or anything like that. The biggest thing is just spending a little bit of time trying to learn these kinds of tools and start to get yourself moving up that learning curve. It is steep at first, but it definitely plateaus pretty quickly. And so getting your toe in the water is kind of an important step. UW Cooperative Extension Technology Services does offer their Tech Tuesday program, so you probably know about that. They also have a paper about choosing different technologies that they put out over the summer, back in July, and that's being continually updated. And there's a number of other resources that are available through Extension, through the Journal of Extension, that are listed here, as well as through UW colleges. So a lot of educators are thinking about this. They're working in this space. This is a fast-moving area. I mean, obviously, the kinds of tools and technologies are going to be different a year from now, and so this is going to be something we have to sort of keep up with over time. But I do think there's some real advantages here, everything from getting more people into the classroom to reaching people who wouldn't come in your classroom otherwise, and then leveraging the impact of what you already do. I'll pause, and if folks have questions or examples of ideas they want to share, I'd welcome that now. I think we had a general mute now. I think it's open if anybody has a comment. Sorry for that. Okay, with that, I will wrap things up today, but I thank you all for your participation. Have a great week, and I look forward to you being part of our next call. Our next call is actually going to be, we're going to skip over our December call for the holidays. So we will meet again on January 20th, and we're going to talk about employer-based workplace financial education. So that'll be that Monday, January 20th. Thanks, everybody, and have a great week.